Welcome to episode 44 of the Brewbound podcast. Please note that you're listening to an updated version in which we've removed the host banter due to some offensive content that it contained. You can read more about it, as well as read an apology to our valued listeners and the community at www.brewbound.com/podcast apology. Please enjoy our interview with Julie Verratti, the co-founder of Maryland's Denizens Brewing Company.
Chris Fornari and Justin Kendall here for the Brewbound podcast. Today we are in Riverdale, Maryland at the brand new secondary location for Denizens Brewing. And co-founder Julie Verratti has been kind enough to make some time for us before she sprints into D.C. for a Brewers Association meeting. She's also the chair of the Brewers Association's Diversity Committee and a Brewpub representative on the board. Julie, welcome to the pod.
Thanks so much for having me. Thanks for being here, guys.
Yeah, this is a beautiful space you have here, not even open to the public yet, and all the tables are set. You're ready for everyone to come storming in here.
That's the hope, because this was expensive.
Yeah, well, let's start there, I guess. I mean, with the second location, obviously, you know, your business is going to sort of change completely overnight. You're going to have a lot more capacity to brew. Mm-hmm. You're going to be managing two locations, two brew pub locations. Walk us through the process of what it's like to open a second facility, what you learned along the way, what you regret,
yeah.
What you wish you knew, all that stuff.
Wish I knew and regret is that Emily, Jeff, and I are not independently wealthy just to pay for all this stuff. When you're building something at this capacity, it's very capital intensive. I mean, even opening up a nano brewery is capital intensive. So doing it this scale definitely costs a lot of money. So debt financing, doing all of that, that's very stressful. You know, you have to put your home up as collateral in order to secure the loan on top of all the equipment. So that part can be a little stressful. You know, the thing that has really been consistent for us since the beginning, you know, our first location, our 5-year anniversary is this July. So we've been doing this for about 5 years now. You know, the fact that we have three of us that are in it every day with three, I would say, very different skill sets, I think helps move the project forward. I would say that Emily Bruno, who's my business partner and also my wife, has an incredible skill set in terms of project management. And so she's really been the one overseeing all the different, you know, nooks and crannies of all the things that, from everything from, hey, you forgot to caulk that area in the bathroom, to, you know, making sure the boiler is getting inspected, to, you know, you name it.
Yeah.
And so that's been really helpful to have her on the team doing that. You know, and Jeff, he's been brewing professionally for over 10 years now. And so he's got a lot of experience in seeing how different breweries work. You know, Denizens, I think, is the third or the fourth brewery that he's worked with professionally. You know, he helped found it. He's also one of my other business partners. He's another owner. And so having his skill set of knowing what to look for in terms of what we wanted for brewing equipment, knowing people in the industry to ask questions about things he doesn't know, that's been really helpful. And then I've been running around trying to figure out which distributors we're going to be signing with. And so that's been really fun. I've been definitely learning a lot about that. You know, we've been self-distributing since day one. So I've been learning a whole lot of different things.
So are you going to maintain self-distribution and, you know, sort of bring on new distributors for locations that you just can't service?
Yeah, I mean, our plan is to self-distribute in Montgomery County, Maryland for as long as we possibly can, which I assume will probably be forever. The Montgomery County is actually the only jurisdiction in the country that the government has complete control over alcohol distribution. So if you're a licensee, you buy all of your alcohol from the Department of Liquor Control, whether it's spirits, it's wine, it's beer. There are a few carve-outs for smaller breweries, wineries, and distilleries that can self-distribute in the county. That was actually one of the laws that we helped get passed in 2014 in order for us to self-distribute there. So we're going to keep doing that, but we're looking to sign with someone for the rest of Maryland, all of DC, And then Northern Virginia, we already have a distribution partner.
Very nice. So what's that process been like going from, you know, 5 years of, you know, knowing self-distribution and brewpub life, like, you know, the back of your hand to we're changing our business model now, and I've got to figure out what distributor in 2019, when there's thousands of other brands that they could carry, is gonna take my brand and care for it.
It's been scary. It's also sort of staring down the reality of not knowing what you don't know and trying to learn it as quickly as possible. That's been another experience. And just, you know, interviewing a lot of distributors and interviewing, asking other distributors what they think about other distributors, asking retailers what they think, asking breweries what they think, and narrowing it down from there.
Well, I mean, it's a long process, and it's something that, you know, you're pretty much in it for life. It's a marriage when you think about, you know, all the different franchise laws that exist. So.
That's true. Although Maryland did just pass franchise reform this year, finally. And we will be below the cap in terms of who it applies to in terms of production. So that doesn't kick in until January of 2020. But franchise reform was made very real in Maryland this session. So it made it a little less intimidating knowing that that existed.
Right. Do you feel courted?
Do I feel courted?
Yeah, by the wholesalers or?
It's a little mixture of both. It's funny, some of them I feel very courted by, and then some I feel like they're like, take it or leave it. You know, it's a very, even just 2 years ago, it's a very different landscape.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of, you know, I've definitely heard distributors say that. You know, if I was talking to you 2 years ago, I would probably cut you a check for a much larger amount.
Yeah, that was
the rights to your brand.
That was going to be my question.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, which direction? Because, I mean, imagine 2 years ago, there were still a lot of breweries, and, you know, we were hearing it that distributors didn't want to take on new brands that long ago. Mm-hmm. So it's only gotten worse.
It has. I mean, I do think that, you know, over the 5 years, we have really, really built our brand, and we've built it in combination of having distribution. You know, we obviously self-distribute, but we drive all over Maryland. So we're in Frederick, we're in Baltimore. We sell a lot of beer in DC, so it's not like folks are not familiar with our brand. We're not a brand new brewery that has to build the brand from the ground up. So I think that that's helped us.
So looking at this place is gorgeous.
Thank you.
And you've got all these gigantic stainless steel tanks and everything in here. And I mean, to take on a project like this at a time when craft is kind of slowed and then everything's become
still growing though.
Yes, still growing. But become more competitive, too.
Sure.
What sort of gave the three of you the confidence to sort of take on a project like this at this time?
I think a couple of reasons. One is, you know, if I was a brand new brewery right now that had not opened yet, I would probably hesitate on opening a brand new one. The fact that we're, you know, almost 5 years old and our brand does have some recognition in this area gives us a little bit more confidence. You know, where we're located now, we're 6 miles away from the original location. And, you know, we are a brew pub model. So we have a full restaurant. We have regulars that come in and drink our beer right there in the brew pub tap room. And 6 miles away, I think, is just far enough away that we're not going to be eating into our current guests in Silver Spring, but it's not so far away that folks over here have never heard of us.
Right.
So I feel confident about that. That's number one. Number two, you know, even at max capacity here, I mean, we're going from a 15-barrel brew house going into 15-barrel fermenters to a 30-barrel brew house going into 60-barrel fermenters. And I think that even at max capacity, we're never going to be above 15,000 barrels. And I don't even see that happening for at least another 8 to 10 years. And I think that that's a sweet spot right now in craft. You know, if we were going from, you know, we did 1,500 barrels last year. If we were going from that to 50,000 barrels, I think that's where you start getting into trouble. Whereas here, going up to 15,000, I think it's more manageable. And part of that is a lifestyle choice. Like, I have no interest, and I don't think Emily nor Jeff have the interest of waking up in the middle of the night and like panic sweats, like, oh my God, I have to sell 25,000 barrels over the next 6 months. How the hell am I going to do that? I'm not interested in that. You know, I think.
You're not?
No, definitely not. I mean, there are some people who really get a thrill out of that.
Yeah.
Obviously not the panic stuff, but like get the thrill of like, they want to sell and be in distribution. Good for them. That's not me. I do like selling, but I like to keep it a little bit more low key on that. I think the fact that we have two tap rooms, we have a full restaurant in both locations. You know, we do sell wine and spirits in our brew pubs as well. It makes me feel more comfortable about sending more beer into distribution because the tap rooms will help sort of pay the bills, if that makes sense.
Yeah. When you think about your own business model, and even when you mentioned, you know, taking on some debt to build this thing, mm-hmm. when you talk about your business to the lender mm-hmm. or when you think about writing a business plan, do you see yourselves more closer to a restaurant business or more closer to a production brewery business? Because, I mean, you got the 30-barrel system. That's right. Nothing to sneeze at. But at the same time, you are still kind of playing in that restaurant space.
I mean, I think we're both, and we tell them we're both. You know, it's one of the things that Emily and I talk about this a lot. Like, one of the things that is really fun about owning a brewery is that it is so diverse in terms of what you do every day. You know, it's manufacturing, it's retail, it's wholesale distribution, it's hospitality. You've got all these different things going on. Lots of things to learn every day. You know, lots of things to screw up, but also some great successes. And I think that, you know, describing it to banks, again, this is all part of Emily's skill set in terms of her project management and able to communicate the business model very clearly to the lenders, I think has really helped us have relationships with banks.
Now, you said it was expensive to build this place. Mm-hmm. Was that because of front of house or because of what's, you know, behind us where we're recording in the brewery?
It was because it was built from scratch, because it was a completely empty shell, gravel floors. So we had to put the HVAC system into the whole building. We had to put all of the plumbing from scratch, all of the gas, all of the electrical. The positive thing about that is that we were able to build exactly what we wanted. The negative thing about that is usually when you go into a building that already exists, you know, that stuff that I just said to you is millions of dollars to put in a 12,000 square foot building.
Right.
So that's really a lot of why it was even more expensive. I mean, the restaurant side, tap room side, and the production side, I mean, it's all expensive.
Yeah. It's a multi-million dollar project.
Yeah.
And you're financing it primarily with debt, you said?
Primarily, not all.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
the landlord is helping out at some level. So they're helping with paying for part of it as part of the lease agreement.
Yeah, I mean, some of the infrastructure
like,
that you're putting in for sure.
Stuff, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it does seem like we've seen a lot of instances where breweries have taken on a considerable amount of debt in mm-hmm. order to grow. And, you know, it looks different depending upon what scenario you're talking about.
Sure.
It could be we're building a brand new $50 million brewery. It
right.
could
well,
be
it's
we're,
definitely not that
yeah.
much.
It could be we're
no
expanding
way.
All across the country. I mean, there's
right.
a bunch of different reasons why breweries have taken on a lot of debt in order to grow and kind of chase it. And in some cases, we've seen those breweries get kind of bitten by that.
Sure.
Does that ever kind of keep you up at night knowing that, you know, you built up a bunch of debt to build this thing and
yeah.
But like how did but how did you structure it so that you could still, you know, grow modestly, like mm-hmm. you said, and not wake up with, you know, in the middle of the night with sweats and
yeah.
you know, kind of live a normal lifestyle while you still have some debt, you know, hanging over the business.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I would describe this as a normal lifestyle in general.
As but, normal as it gets in
exactly.
beer.
You know, I don't know the answer to that. I feel confident that we did. I mean, I do think that, and I'm confident in the sense that, you know, all of the projections we put out in terms of the construction budget is almost to the penny accurate from what we thought it was going to be.
Wow.
That seems
again,
rare.
So yeah. Emily Bruno, I'm telling you, she could have a second career in this stuff. So that's number one. Number two, yes, it's a lot of debt, but in the grand scale of things, it's not as much debt as I've seen people, you know, from reading your publication, like the types of debt that people are taking on.
Yeah.
And I think we've structured it in a way where relying on revenues in the tap room, relying on some of the self-distribution, and again, obviously with distributor partners as well, I think that we're going to be able to grow. And unfortunately, you know, it takes money to make money. And if you're not independently wealthy, the only real option is debt financing.
Yeah.
And we're lucky that we were even able to get debt financing. There's a lot of companies out there that can't get debt financing. So we're lucky that we're even in that position.
Have you noticed that the whole financing situation has sort of changed from when you opened the first place to now?
Yes and no. I mean, we still had to like ask multiple banks. It's funny, the first time we went and got debt financing from the original build out, I mean, we had to bootstrap everything. We We asked for $1 million. They only gave us 500. And that was only after we got like a state-based, you know, guarantee program for us to even get the 500. We built a lot of things ourselves. You know, we bought a bunch of pizza and beer for our friends and painted the outside of the building to save $5,000. Like, nice. Different things like that. So it was definitely more difficult to get the financing the first time around. And I think part of that is just, it's a startup business. We didn't have any operating history. Mm-hmm. This time around, the bank that we went with the first time, I think they had been burned by some other breweries that they had financed. Mm. And they just were sort of like, we're getting out of the brewery financing business, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And so they wanted to finance it, but we needed just a little bit more money than they were willing to lend. So we went with a different bank who gave us what we needed.
Very nice.
But we weren't aggressive about it. I mean, we asked for what we needed and didn't ask for more than that.
Well, it seems like the secret formula is not biting off more than you can chew.
Right.
And understanding that if you don't grow at, you know, some exponential rate, mm-hmm. you can still service the debt
right.
and have modest growth. And
exactly.
I guess that's what I was sort of getting at is like, you know, how did you structure it so that, you know, you don't
right.
need to wake up and be like, oh shit, like well, we got to get 400 people through here on a Tuesday, you know, in the
That'd
middle of the
great.
Winter.
yeah. I mean, we structured it. It's a 10-year loan. It's an SBA guaranteed loan. So there are different programs out there that can help you sort of decrease the amount of debt you need to get.
Very nice. Well, switching gears a little bit, we mentioned it up at the top. You're the chair of the diversity committee, mm-hmm. the Brewers Association Diversity Committee. That's obviously, you know, a big topic of interest in the beer industry right
yeah.
now, diversity and inclusion. We've talked about it here on the podcast at our mm-hmm. Brew Talks event. And, you know, just kind of wanted to get your thoughts about some of the conversations that are happening throughout the industry right now
mm-hmm.
and what your take is on, you know, what's happening and where you'd like to see those conversations go.
I've been really heartened by the amount of engagement out there that has happened in the diversity and inclusion discussion. I think that Dr. J is doing an incredible job. I mean, she is seriously just banging it up out there. And I am so proud of the work that she's doing. The diversity committee is an interesting committee to be the chair of. It's almost like a figurehead position because I'm LGBT, I'm a woman, but like that doesn't make me an expert in diversity and inclusion, right?
Right.
Whereas like the chair of the technical committee or the chair of the safety committee, they actually are experts in those things,
right?
Right. So they're a lot more hands-on, whereas I've really relied on Dr. J to like really run the ship and run the show. And I think most people probably see that. I mean, she's out there all the time. I know she was on your panel at the Brew Talks recently. That was great, by the way. I listened to it. It was a great conversation. So yeah, I think a lot of people are engaged, especially you see it on social media. You know, I'm hoping that also translates that's happening in person with people as well. But yeah, we've been doing a lot of exciting projects. I'm excited about the grants that we just sent out for the first time. You know, we did $20,000 worth of grants for different events that are focused on diverse audiences. And I thought that was pretty great. It's something that, you know, we're looking at, you know, at least doing what we did this year and maybe growing that program at some point. We just want to see how it goes. But yeah, it's been really exciting. It's been a great year
yeah.
for that.
What was it like to sort of sort through those grants and sort of choose the ones that were accepted?
Well, I will tell you, there were 51 applicants, which is a huge amount. There was no way we'd be able to give money to all 51 applicants. I mean, I think part of it was, you know, we had like a whole rating system, and part of it was looking at, you know, first of all, how much money are they asking for? Is this even in the realm of possibility for us? Who's the audience that they're working towards, whether it's consumer or it's, you know, within the industry? Like a couple of the grants that we gave out were about workforce development.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's one in the Boston area that's going to be working to recruit diverse candidates to come work in beer.
Mm-hmm.
So really just sort of looking at what are the outcomes they're looking for? Is this a reasonable ask that they're making? Are we actually going to make an impact on whether this event will happen if we give this grant out? And then also just looking at sort of the professionalism of the application.
So it sounds like you guys were kind of trying to hit a sweet spot of
mm-hmm.
like, how far can we see this money go?
Yeah.
And, you know, can we impact as many people as possible
exactly.
with the funds that we have?
Exactly.
Nice.
Yeah.
Staying on the topic of diversity and inclusion in the industry, I'm sort of curious to learn, you know, more about, as much as you're able to share, like internally, when you guys have committee meetings, you know, mm-hmm. you mentioned being more of a figurehead.
That's what it feels like.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you describe it like that, because it makes a ton of sense when you compare it to, say, like a technical committee.
Right.
That's something that you can learn and you can be trained to learn,
mm-hmm.
whereas the diversity piece is experience-based.
Right.
And it has to be learned through everybody else's or everybody's individual unique experience. So
mm-hmm.
your experience is going to be different from Dr. J, is going to be different
right.
from, you know, the next guy.
Sure.
And I'm curious what those conversations are like when you guys get together. What do you guys talk about?
Mm-hmm.
What are the issues that are being brought up most often?
Mm-hmm.
What questions are you guys getting? Like, what's happening in these meetings?
Yeah, I mean, and I think that Dr. J can speak to about this a lot as well, because as the ambassador, part of her job is to travel around the country, speak to guilds, answer questions from people, collect questions from people. So we will usually talk to, you know, ask Dr. J, like, what questions did you get this week while you're out traveling or this month? We'll discuss some of that. We talk about what are some programs that we can create through the BA that focus on diversity and inclusion. I mean, the grant program came out of conversations that we've had in our committee meetings about how do we actually make a meaningful impact on this instead of just talking about it, actually taking action. We're looking at piloting a mentorship program as well. That's the second big thing that we're working on. Looking at, you know, how do we collect data both externally in terms of who's drinking our beer and who's not drinking our beer.
Right.
And then also internally, where are we at within the industry? How many women are working in beer? How yep. many, you know, people of color are working in beer? Trying to make sure we collect that data so we have a baseline and then say, okay, here's where we can try to make an impact. One actually really interesting thing for social media, Kevin, who you met earlier, is our operations manager. He was looking at, you know, what do our followers look like on Instagram or Twitter? And actually, we have a majority female followers on Instagram for Denizens, which is, I think, kind of unheard of as a beer brand, but most of our followers on Instagram are women.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's because Kevin helps with Instagram now, but for a long time it was just women running Instagram. So I don't know if it's just sort of like the audience is reacting and relating to people posting on Instagram. I'm not sure. You know, we do a lot of things where we talk about women's empowerment. We talk about, you know, being part of the community means supporting the community that you're in. Montgomery County and Prince George's County. So Montgomery County is where the Silver Spring location is, and Prince George's is where we are right now in Riverdale. It's an extremely diverse area. You know, so for us, you come into our, and I don't know this to be true just yet now because we haven't opened to the public yet here, but I have a feeling it'll be this way. You know, in Silver Spring, you find all ages, all ethnicities, genders, race, you know, sexual orientation. I mean, they're all over the place every single day.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like one majority thing.
Did that factor in on site selection when you were looking for a second location?
I don't know if that factored in on it. I just think, you know, we're lucky to live in an area where we do, mm-hmm. where it is a very diverse community,
yeah.
regardless of where you go.
Yeah.
So it just sort of, by default, that's how it is here.
Yeah. yeah. So how do you, you know, activate that community that's around you and not only get them interested in just the craft beer mm-hmm. industry and the craft beer scene, but tap into it as a potential source of a potential employee base.
Mm-hmm.
You know, folks that can actually come in here and work on the packaging line or work mm-hmm. the bar or work the front of the house.
Well, it's been hard for us to find people to apply here, actually, which has been a little frustrating. You know, we've reached out to some of the local county and town resources and said, hey, can you connect us with any job source organizations? You know, we're definitely staffing up at this point. You know, in Silver Spring, most of the people that work there live in and around the Silver Spring area. You know, we're metro accessible, so it's easy to get to us, which I think makes it easier to hire people from around the area. You know, I think in terms of customers too, you know, we do a lot of events that are community focused. And we do different things, like we have a drag night once a month, which is really fun. That happened just actually to today's Thursday, yesterday. We had a drag night last night.
Very nice.
You know, we try to do things like partner with local community organizations. So this past Saturday, we did a fundraiser for the Humane Society and had like a dog show, right? And so you just sort of, we try to throw events that the folks that live in our community want to do. Mm-hmm. And we try to host them at our place so people will come hang out at our place. And if you partner with enough local organizations that have different interests, as long as they're all supporting the local community is going to come support you.
And eventually those people will probably, at some point, some of them end up working here.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. No, that's definitely a good approach. Internally, you know, you think about having the conversations around diversity, inclusion that we're having throughout the industry right now. What do those conversations look like at Denison's? Like, you know, how are you guys, you know, approaching these topics and what kind of conversations are you having here?
I mean, I think we're just deliberate about it. We talk about it with our team. And when people are coming in, you know, I don't know if you saw, but you walked by, we have our set of values on the wall as staff walks in and out of the kitchen. You know, one of them is craft beers for everyone. We are inclusive to everybody here. And so I probably just butchered the statement. It's a little more eloquent than that, but that's
I like that.
Yeah, it's basically that. You just have to make sure that you have a team that folks know they're supported and that everyone is welcome here. You know, we've had to fire people for, you know, we had an employee a number of years ago who used a derogatory remark against LGBT people, and he was fired immediately.
Yeah. You know, like, clearly that's not going to fly.
Exactly. Yeah. And you say that you do something like that and you communicate that to staff and say, this is why this person was fired. We do not tolerate these type of behavior, you know? And so I think if you build your culture that way, it just sort of naturally is that.
Right. How about with customers? Because that can be a tricky line to walk if somebody is, you know, coming into the tap room or the...
No problem kicking people out.
Yeah. So you just don't care. The customer is not always right.
No, not when it comes to that, no. Yeah.
Through your work with the committee and just in general with the Brewers Association, mm-hmm. how have you seen things sort of evolve from where it was before? And I mean, because it seems like there has been a lot of headway that's been made in, like, I would say probably the last 3 years, mm-hmm. where they've taken a more conscious effort to be more inclusive and try and diversify. Mm-hmm. So how have you seen that headway sort of manifest beyond like grant programs and mm-hmm. that sort of thing?
I think that, you know, adding to some of the goals and part of the, it's not in the mission statement, but sort of like the mission of the BA is looking at increasing diversity. So I think staff is really looking at that. I think that, you know, even sort of crossing over, like, for example, the events committee asked us when they were putting together the plans for CBC for the diversity committee to take a look at some of the ideas they had from our lens to sort of, I don't want to say like check them, but sort of check what they're like, is this something where we're reaching out to more diverse people? So I think that's definitely a change. Mm-hmm. Again, they may have done that prior to my time on the board. I have no idea. But the diversity committee, I think, is coming on its... just finishing our second full year, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We just finished our second full year, so 2.5 years old now.
Well, I mean, to Justin's point, I mean, it feels like it went from, we're going to crack down on offensive names and labels at GABF mm-hmm. to where it is today, which is far more productive conversations happening around a very important topic.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, not to say that it could have happened faster or or it could have happened slower. I mean, 2.5 years seems like a pretty fair time for all that to evolve to the point we are today, but it has come a long way.
No, it definitely has. And I honestly attribute that to the fact that, you know, Bob Pease has made this a priority within the BA, the fact that the board has made it a priority within the BA, and the fact that Dr. J came on as the diversity ambassador. I mean, she has been absolutely incredible in moving this forward.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So speaking of Dr. J, I mean, you know, she basically said, if you want to sell beer to, you know, more diverse communities, you got to let them know that it's not just for white dudes with beards.
Yep.
which makes a ton of sense. So fielding questions from two white dudes with beards, how does craft beer shake its image of, you know, being sort of homogenous in that mm-hmm. way?
Part of it is, you know, making a proactive effort to hire more diverse people within the industry. You know, I think folks like to buy things from people who are like them. And so that's one thing. Number two is proactively trying to create experiences around your beer and your company that involve diverse audiences. And I don't mean sort of like tokenize it, but actually do events that folks want to come to and asking folks from the community to help you put those events on. And partnering with local community organizations is really, really important. And it's something we do all the time and something we're going to continue to do.
Yeah. So what do you see as the future then, knowing kind of where we are today and, you know, possibly where we're headed? What does the industry look like when it is hopefully more diverse? And, you know, are we reaching more people? Does market share grow? Like, what's the eventual outcome of all this?
Oh, I definitely think market share will grow at that point. I mean, if we aren't trying to grow the pie of consumers in every way that we can, we're all going to keep fighting for the same piece of pie. And there's more and more of us that are fighting for that piece of pie now. So it behooves the whole industry to grow that pie. So I think the more diversity we have, both with working within the industry and around the industry, and the growth of more diverse audiences drinking our beer and enjoying our brands, the better it is for everybody. Yeah. It's just going to lift everything.
Well said.
Yeah. I think that's a great way to end it.
I think so too.
And Julie's got places to be.
And also we got to get Julie in an Uber so she can get to her BA meeting. Well, thank you so much for the time. Thank you for giving us a sneak peek
of the new space. Guys.
And congratulations on all your success to now.
Thank you.
Good luck moving forward.
Thanks, guys.
Cheers.
Cheers.